Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Nice to see you, Father Daniel.
Chris, good to see you as well. How's your Lent going?
Well, it seems like Advent takes so long, and then Lent just all of a sudden creeps up on you, and here it is.
Well, that's probably not a bad thing. We all need a little bit of purification and preparation of our hearts for Easter, so it's a good thing to be in Lent.
Some need more purification than others.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, what do you have for us today?
We're going to start with a 34-year-old veterinary student in Brazil who posted on social media in the year 2020 that she doesn't believe that a male can become female. She also posted a link to a video by a Sydney University professor that stated, the professor in the video states, quote, "A person who identifies as transgender retains their birth DNA. No surgery, synthetic hormones, or change of clothes will alter this fact." So for posting these two opinions, this woman has been charged.
Are, this is, sounds like scientific fact to me.
Well, in the eyes of the Brazilian legal system, they are opinions, and she has been charged with the crime of transphobia.
Wow.
Her trial is scheduled soon, and if found guilty, she could be fined and imprisoned for up to 5 years. And even if she's acquitted, right, she faces significant legal bills.
Mm-hmm.
So Brazil's Congress has not passed any law criminalizing transphobia, but their Supreme Court created one by declaration in the year 2019. In June 2019, their high court voted 8-3 to extend protections of an existing law prohibiting racial discrimination in hiring and housing to homosexuals and transgender people. The law also makes defamation, insults, or racial incitement a crime. Mm-hmm. So two things here. One, it's crazy, right, that the Brazilian judicial system that's answering really to nobody can make up their own laws, right? They're not accountable to the citizenry through a vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of scary. But two, is it's just not insane for this level of speech to be criminalized?
It clearly is. And this is the problem with all these hate crime legislations that have been introduced in countries around the world. I just saw an article earlier today of an effort in, I think it was in Ontario, in Canada, to criminalize free speech. Oh, no, it was actually in a school district here in the United States that was trying to pass some sort of a hate crime legislation so that students could not show any sort of this type of evidence referring to scientific data that would somehow counter the transgender agenda.
Well, let's talk about just hate crime in general. I mean, I think the concept of hate crime is ridiculous to begin with. If it's either a crime or it's not. Like if you commit an assault or a battery against somebody, regardless of whether it's for, you know, religious or racial or what other purpose, it's a crime. You don't need to add the hate element into it, which makes everything subjective then on how.
Well, that's the real problem, is the subjectivity that comes into the interpretation of these laws and the way they get weaponized to push an ideology. I think that's the real problem. Now, I think there potentially could be cases where there can be aggravated elements of in a crime. So, for example, let's take what's going on in Nigeria right now, where there's a persecution of Christians, primarily of Catholics, that's being taking place by the hand of Muslims. Okay, and they're attacking these Catholics not because they want their money or they want to take something from them or they want to rape them. There's that element, of course, but they're doing it primarily because they're Catholic.
And I think you bring up a good distinction that it could be an element
of
an aggravating,
yes,
not its own separate crime like we have here in this instance, where because of a post basically expressing her opinion, which is an opinion really of fact. I mean, it's her opinion and how they're characterizing it, but it's a fact.
Yep.
And she's going to potentially go to, I don't know that she'll go to jail for this, but she's, you know, going to be, if she loses, it's going to cost her at the very least a lot of money.
And there's cases like this galore going on in Europe right now, the same type of thing where they're using hate crime legislation in order to prosecute people who are speaking out on things that are just scientific facts that for whatever ideological reasons they want to suppress. So I think this is very problematic as a society when we can't recognize the truth where it is, and we started to create Disney World realities of fictitious versions of reality.
Crosswires. Three Indian children who were siblings jumped to their deaths after their parents confiscated their phone. The three sisters.
This is India.
Bharat City, India.
Okay.
So the three sisters, aged 12, 14, and 16, jumped from their ninth floor balcony at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. The devastated mother and father found an 8-page suicide note in a pocket diary, which included messages about their love of K-pop and the country of Korea in general, and how their parents were attempting to quell this obsession.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know this existed. So according to Indian media, there's this game that's popular in their country where, a lot of kids have become addicted to it. So the game is called We Are Not Indians, and it got popularized during COVID. So part of the game, the last step, is the game gives you different tasks, the last of which is to die by suicide. Okay.
That is crazy.
It's crazy. So it was later reported that two of the sisters may have fallen while trying to hold the third sister back, so we don't know. But seriously, how sick and depraved is this, that over cell phones that we've got children jumping to their death?
Well, and that there's a game that glorifies suicide.
Right.
That's really problematic as a society. And it goes back to the bigger question we've talked about before, Chris, of, is it a wise thing for children to have cell phones and have access to social media or games like this? And then, the whole moral question of, for the developers of these games, what are they thinking?
They're thinking about making money.
Yeah, and that's the problem. When you prioritize economic gain over every other factor, we run into all kinds of moral problems. Well, so there's a lot of things that need to take place here in this situation. Parents need to be vigilant over what their kids are using. How soon should they get a cell phone? When should they start using social media, if ever? It opens up questions about legislation for the country. It opens up moral questions for supervision for these industries and putting penalties upon companies that are creating games like that. We need to humanize all of these elements.
Yeah, we need to, we've talked about it before, follow the lead of Denmark and Australia, they've both banned social media use for children under a certain age, 15 and 16, respectively, for their countries.
And there's certainly a movement afoot for that in the United States as well, looking, because the data that's been coming out in recent years is really, really stark.
Yeah,
I think Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, has really brought to light a lot.
But
of
I've only
elements.
Heard about the banning of TikTok, because of Chinese influence, not for the health of the children.
Right.
Right. People aren't talking about it for the health of the children.
Well, there's been talk about, I think it was Facebook and another company that they were talking about putting pressure on them because they've made their apps addictive and young people can't resist that. So there are questions that are coming up, not just about TikTok, but the studies that have come out actually for the detrimental effects on young women is primarily with Instagram and Facebook. So the studies are coming out now as I think the legislation is starting to follow and awareness of parents on the detrimental effects. But we all need to be more aware and make sure we're choosing the things that are healthy for us.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
According to Gallup, nurses continue to lead other professions in honesty and ethics ratings about their jobs. So only four professions, nurses, military veterans, doctors, and pharmacists, are perceived as having very high ethics.
Mm-hmm.
High school teachers, police officers, accountants, and funeral directors are also rated more positively than negatively by wide margins. Clergy members are in the net positive range, but with a narrower margin. At the other end of the spectrum, there are two professions that are perceived as having low or very low ethics by majorities, and this is the same two professions that keep coming up year after year. What do you think those might be?
Well, probably politicians.
Congress?
Uh-huh. Congress is definitely one of those. Media?
Telemarketers.
Oh, telemarketers.
Yeah, so just what do you think this says about where we're headed in America, I kind of found it interesting. Nurses are top rated.
Well, I can tell you why. I spent a lot of time in the hospital myself when I was going through my cancer treatments, and I came away with a really newfound respect for nurses. They work really hard. They have 12-hour shifts. They're trying to manage that with caring for their family, and they're taking care of people when they're at their most vulnerable. when they've, and they really appreciate that care that nurses provide. And when you know that someone cares about you and they've done acts of charity to serve you, that increases a person's trust level tremendously.
Yeah, it's interesting, right, that you mentioned that, because I think of nurses versus, and you know, doctors were also rated positively, but nurses above doctors. And why is that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you go to the doctor, you're oftentimes wondering, is he writing this prescription for me because I need it?
Right.
Or is it because he got taken to dinner last night by the farmer?
The drug rep.
Whereas with a nurse, you don't have any such, you know, pretense.
Yeah. Well, nurses also tend to, they're in the room more often. They're spending more time with you. They'll engage with you in conversation. Whereas typically when a doctor comes in, they're rushed. They're trying to get to the next patient. They're not as engaged with you on a personal level typically. And so, yeah, it makes perfect sense to me that a nurses would be greater appreciated.
It's a little disappointing to me, though, to see clergy as ranked below high school teachers, police officers, accountants, and funeral directors. I mean, funeral directors, for me, I don't know if you've ever had to deal with funeral directors.
Not a whole lot.
Well, I had to do this with both my parents organizing their funerals, and it's almost all of the, quote, mom and pop funeral homes around the country have mm-hmm. been rolled up by private equity into a single entity. And so it's, I think it's Service Corp International that owns them, almost all of them.
Mm.
And it is not, I mean, it's a business. There's nothing,
clearly.
There is no vocation element to it with them, trying to empathize with the, you know, newly dealing with death clients. So, I'm surprised to see funeral directors as above clergy.
Yeah, but they're also dealing with people in a very vulnerable time of their lives when they're helping work through the death of a loved one. So I can see that. Typically, when people serve others in vulnerable moments, they're going to gain more trust. And I think there's been so many high profile cases of, you know, sexual abuse or mismanagement of funds. Anytime a clergy member does something wrong, it's blasted over the news.
And I think that's part of it.
It's less so.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any more or less, hopefully there's less, malfeasance from clergy. I think it just gets publicized when it's, you know, if you're a particularly a Catholic clergy, if you're a clergy member of a Protestant denomination, it's far less likely that the, say, abuse scandal that you've been through is going to be publicized. But if it's Catholic, it's going to make front page news.
I mean, there's well met documented cases about that. I remember seeing there was a public school district that had a 10% incidence of sexual abuse of minors of teachers perpetrating abuse on minors. Never came out as a story, and the percentage among Catholic clergies, you know, in the worst places was like 2.5% of clergy were carrying
out.
Right,
in the very worst places, yeah.
In the worst places. So there's a total discrepancy, but the only thing you see in the media is the clergy, and particularly Catholic clergy, that they get highlighted. I remember stories of, there was a story of a Protestant pastor who sexually abused some children, and it was just squashed, didn't make it out into the headlines. And there was allegation of abuse by a Catholic priest, and broadcast everywhere. So there's a double standard, and that definitely contributes to discrediting of the clergy. But I think interesting fact also, when you talk with people, survey after survey of Catholics, they say that their trust in their pastor is very high. So like 80, 90%. Their trust of clergy in general is very low.
Mm.
So the people that they know, they trust in. So whenever you read these surveys, you also have to see how they worded it, how they approached the topic. Because if they asked the question differently, I guarantee you'd get a different result.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, the editorial board asks, can a public school district refuse to hire a K-12 teacher if she won't use transgender pronouns? So the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said yes in a recent decision. Yes, they can refuse to hire. Kimberly Polk was a substitute teacher in Montgomery County, Maryland, until the district required her to affirm the policy of addressing students with their preferred pronouns. She objected to that, as well as the requirement that students must grant permission before teachers discuss gender issues with their parents, that they have to get the permission of the student first. So in the court's view, in the majority, the Maryland school board hasn't infringed anyone's rights by setting these rules for teachers. One judge noted that it's just part of the job and that accepting her role as teacher subjects her to a degree of control by the democratically elected board. In the dissent, this is, by the way, a 2-1 vote. So in the dissent, the one judge notes that this makes teachers vulnerable to becoming the unwilling mouthpieces of government messaging, as states that disagree with transgender ideology might enact policies preventing teachers from using preferred pronouns. So then what would you do then? So this is like another case of gender fluidity being treated as an accepted, you know, scientific fact. And I can only wonder what this school board would do if they required, or what this teacher would do, or teachers in this district would do if the school board required them to address students who, you know what furries are, right? People who identify as furries.
Yes, I've heard that.
So what if we go there and they now are required to, you know, address this person as a whatever, a dog?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, insanity.
It has become ridiculous in so many manifestations of this in our culture. And I think we just need to return to some basic common sense.
Well, can you think of another thing where we've twisted ourselves in such a pretzel other than the preferred pronoun category?
Oh, we have, certainly, throughout all of history. This is the tendency of government to impose a worldview and an ideology.
Give me an example where we've gone so contra the plain basic facts of science.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of one? It seems like we're hitting bottom at this one.
We're hitting pretty low. Yeah, we definitely are. But there are other cases throughout history where the manipulation of language, the way that you call people. I mean, even in our own country during World War II, you look back at some of the language that was used to refer to Japanese. You know, the Japs, the Yellow Bellies, all kinds of things that demean the human person, that twist the reality and strip away the dignity.
But you weren't required to refer to folks as those names. In this instance, requiring
Correct.
Somebody to refer to something that they aren't is just insanity.
Yeah. But there's been the flip side of things. For example, AP guidelines stipulate that you cannot use the term pro-life.
Right.
You have to use anti-choice.
Right.
The very framing of the language conveys something. So this is a typical tactic. When a dictatorial power wants to impose a worldview and impose their values, you shift the language. Don't allow certain things and impose other ways of speaking.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
The British Journal of Sports Medicine released what it calls the most comprehensive synthesis of studies yet. According to them, this study counters the idea that men have advantages over women in sports.
Oh, really?
That's right.
Oh, interesting.
They synthesized a series of 52 different studies in Brazil. I'm not sure why the British Journal of Sports Medicine is taking studies from Brazil, but these Brazilian studies included roughly 6,500 participants. They note that trans women had higher absolute lean body mass than cis women, which I still don't know where this word cis comes from. But anyways, I will
use it. That's a manipulation of language. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm quoting here, but found no significant differences in fitness metrics such as upper body strength, lower body strength, and maximum oxygen consumption after the trans women underwent 1 to 3 years of gender affirming care, there's no way they found that these things were to be the case, but maybe they were testing 5 year
olds. The very fact that they're taking these studies out of Brazil, which is known for some of this manipulation of data.
Is that right?
Oh gosh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, because it was a compilation of different studies and not their own study, the researchers could not establish, quote, direct correlations between muscle mass and functional strength. We've talked about this before, that the average male, the strongest female on average lifts 150 to 200 pounds less than just the average male.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just no comparison on, you know, muscle mass and strength. So, we've talked about this numerous times and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's another example of, if you repeat a lie enough times that people are going to believe it, which is, of course, where's that quote come from?
Pravda.
Nazi Germany.
Well, also and communist Russia.
Yeah,
that was the motto for Pravda, which was the official paper of the Communist Party, which Pravda means truth.
Right.
And they say if you repeat a lie enough times, it becomes a truth.
So in a related matter, I don't know if you remember this, but in the 2024 Paris Olympics, there was the Algerian boxer. So this fellow was boxing. He's a guy boxing against women.
Right.
And he was claiming that he had no Y chromosome. So he has just come out and affirmed that he, in fact, has a Y chromosome after repeatedly denying it over the years. So during these Olympics, he was competing, boxing against multiple different females. He was going against an Italian female who tapped out 46 seconds into the fight after getting punched only twice. She said after the fight that those were the hardest blows she's ever encountered. So you know, I remember thinking at the time, if any of these gals that he boxed had a brother, they need to go find this guy and give him what he deserves. So, you know, the insanity continues.
It does.
I mean, where are we going to finally have a wake up here?
That's
when
a really
somebody
good
gets
question.
Hurt. Is it going to take that?
No, people have already gotten hurt. And I was just reading an article the other day about a girl who was wrestling against a transgender so-called girl, but it was actually a boy.
Right.
And, you know, inappropriate grabbing was going on. The girl just let herself be pinned and get out of it because she was like so like mortified. I mean, these type of things are going on. It is a disgrace. It is a disgrace.
But then what does this say about where Britain, and we've talked many times about how they are, you know, they're just racing to the bottom on various different issues with, you know, incest, redefining whether incest is proper or not.
Right. Yeah, but that's not across the board. I mean, there are British people who are very much aware of this.
No, it's not across the board, but just generally, all these institutions in Britain seem to be faltering at the same time.
Well, I think Brits would look at the United States and look at all these universities putting out these studies and this bizarre stuff and politicians, and they look at us and see all these protests going on in the streets, and it's like, wow, the United States is falling apart. So it's easy to point the finger at others, but I think each one of us has to do what we can in our community, in our circles, to bring people back to sanity. Let's look at the scientific facts. Let's not try to create alternative realities that are dissociated from basic human and biological truths.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
When the Trump administration targeted billions of dollars recently in welfare fraud, he singled out five Democratic-run states. But an examination by the Wall Street Journal found that the main federal welfare program known as TANF has long been plagued by poor financial oversight and questionable spending in states led by both Democrats and Republicans.
Sure.
So the way TANF funds work is they flow as block grants to states, giving them wide latitude to spend with minimal reporting requirements, which is supposed to allow the states to get creative in serving the poor.
Sure.
So in reality, the money has gone in this Wall Street Journal compilation of findings that the money has gone to various things, including, you know, that are not direct aid to the poor: college scholarships for middle or upper income families, anti-abortion centers, a volleyball stadium in Mississippi. There was one that was an Ohio job training nonprofit where the employees were later sentenced to prison after a prosecutor said they used the TANF money for vacations and real estate. So on average, about 849,000 families got direct cash aid each month in fiscal 2025. Federal data shows that's down from 1.9 million people getting direct aid in the year 2010. So states are often using TANF money as a slush fund to plug budget shortfalls or finance initiatives that don't help poor people. Hayden Dubois from the Foundation for Government Accountability describes the TANF lack of oversight as, quote, fraud by design. So is this another example of our civic leaders not being versed in the wisdom of Catholic social doctrine, of one of which is the concept of subsidiarity, which is saying that decisions should be made at the most local level possible? So in this instance, you're giving the money to the states, but they're not the ones responsible for generating. So they have no sort of, you know, emotional or moral, you know, tie to distributing it properly, because it's free money.
Yeah. No, it's a clear case of just the human tendency when there's no accountability, when there's not the oversight, when you don't have a vested interest in what's there, and when you can take advantage of the system, people will take advantage of it. And this is one of the reasons why the principle of subsidiarity within the Catholic Church is great wisdom. You know, get the money out of the hands of the powerful who are distant away from the needs of the people. Give it to the people who are closest to them, and have the people do the best they can with it. Now, this opens up a whole other question about, should we be taxing and taking the money to the central government anyway in the first place? What if we taxed less and create a system in which we encourage people to give more to local agencies which are in touch with the real needs in their own community?
Or if you're going to tax, only tax local, so that the people who are, you're seeing the impact of the people you're taxing, and therefore you feel some responsibility to properly distribute the funds.
Right.
So less federal, more state taxation.
Certainly. But I've heard the opposite argument. And when I was going through my doctoral studies, when we had a course on public policy, the basic supposition was that there's big problems in the world that only the government could solve. Now, I don't agree with that.
But we're talking about the government here, but we're just talking about doing it at the local level, not the federal level.
Right. But the counter argument would be, oh, well, what about these big problems? How can we solve these big problems like poverty?
National defense is obvious. You have to have a federal military.
I'm just saying this
military.
Is the counter argument. I don't agree with it. I think it's a fallacious argument, and I think the statistics from and the facts from a historical basis prove that it doesn't work that way. I would totally agree that it's better to keep it at the local level. And I think that's what we should be pushing to is informed citizenry. We should be looking at what's working and what's not.
Years ago, I did a study group on the Catholic, the Compendium of Catholic Social Doctrine.
It's a great document,
by the way. After reading that document, which was in a book form, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, every politician in America should be required, whether they're Catholic or not, mm-hmm. to read this and how... You know, you're supposed to be working for the common good. Right. Of course, no one would ever allow that because it comes from Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But it was such a guidebook. You know, it was almost like Proverbs is for a, you know, sort of instruction manual for life.
Sure.
It's an instruction manual for politicians.
Right. Totally. I think that's a great idea. At least if
it's not going to happen.
Well,
if you took Catholic out of it, it might.
You could take the cover off of it.
Yeah,
and take all the references out and just say, here's a document on how we could better run our society. And you take those principles of Catholic social teaching and apply them in our public forum. It'd be awesome. We'd be much better off as a country.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.